Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part two of a fine talk by Vincent Emmanuel. It's about the three ongoing disasters of our time, and maybe a couple things we the people can do about them. I hope you'll stay tuned. Vincent Emmanuel was a fairly ordinary guy from the Midwest. Sharper than average, for sure, though that may have become obvious only later. After somebody attacked the World Trade Center, Emmanuel decided to stand up for America. So he enlisted in the United States Marine Corps, which sent him off to Iraq. Twice, in fact. In Iraq, he saw American forces engaging in needless brutality and serious war crimes. Of course, the invasion itself was a war crime. Emmanuel refused to go back for a third deployment. I'm not sure exactly how, but he and the Marine Corps somehow parted ways. He and the military-industrial complex parted ways. He and the national security state parted ways. He joined the organization Iraq Veterans Against the War and became one of its leaders. In last week's talk, Emmanuel spoke movingly about the collapse of the peace movement. The peace movement collapsed pretty much the moment Obama was elected in 2008. Anti-war organizations, to which Emmanuel had devoted years of hard work, just lay down and went to sleep. Maybe there never really was an anti-war movement in the 2000s, Emmanuel reflected. Maybe it was just an anti-Bush movement. I admire idealists. I especially admire idealists who stick with their ideals, even after those ideals fall out of fashion. Emmanuel never stopped his anti-war activism, but his concerns have broadened to include other issues. Best of all, he shows how the issues are interconnected. Well, I told you he was sharper than average. The obvious similarity here is with Martin Luther King near the end of his life. King came to realize that you can't talk about civil rights without talking about justice, and you can't talk about justice without talking about the excesses of corporate capitalism and about economic justice. And you've also got to talk about the infernal Pentagon war machine that has killed more black Americans than all the Southern sheriffs combined. The war machine that is sucking the funds out of anti-poverty programs like some gigantic demonic suction tube. Well, I'm not saying that Vincent Emmanuel is King's equal, but I do admire the way both of them see and explain the interconnectedness of our nation's problems. In his talk, Emmanuel discussed three interconnected problems. They are the collapse of American society, global militarization, and the environmental disaster, all of them now well underway. Last week, he discussed the collapse of American society and militarization, and just began his talk about ecology and the environment. This week, he'll focus on the environment and then reflect on steps the people can take to try to reduce the damage from all three. Note the stress on the people taking steps. The government has done almost nothing to halt any of the three disasters and probably never will. Or so Emmanuel concludes, and I think he's right. In Orwell's 1984, the character Winston Smith says, "If there is any hope, it'll have to come from the proles." That's us. Here is Vincent Emmanuel.
Interestingly, the military is way ahead of the civilian state apparatus when it comes to climate change. A recent Guardian headline from 2 days ago reads, quote, "Military experts say climate change poses the most significant risk to security around the globe. A coalition of 25 prominent members of U.S. national state security community warned that higher temperatures and rising seas will inundate bases, because we have over 1,500 military bases, including in the United States, around the world, and fuel conflict, not to mention massive migrations on a level unprecedented in human history. Dar Jamail, in my opinion, one of the best reporters out there. I consider him a friend and someone that I think everyone should pay attention to his work. So Dar Jamail, reporting at Truthout, recently spoke to Dr. Peter Wadhams. That's Wadhams. I suggest checking out his work as well. So Dr. Wadhams suggests that Arctic sea ice could completely disappear in the next 2 years. This would be the first time in more than 10,000 years that Arctic sea ice has completely disappeared. The immediate consequences, according to Wadhams and Dar Jamail, includes, quote, the loss from the shallow shelf areas north of Siberia is dangerous. Why? Because it encourages emissions of methane from the seabed as an offshore permafrost melts. Secondly, the loss from Baffin Bay and East Greenland in summer encourages warm winds over the Greenland ice sheet, which cause ice sheet melt and accelerated sea level rise. Recent headlines highlight Wadhams' warnings. Another Guardian article notes, quote, a new study partly sponsored by NASA's Space Goddard Flight Center has highlighted the prospect that global industrial civilization could collapse in coming decades due to unsustainable resource exploitation and increasingly unequal wealth distribution. Even more conservative climate activists, such as Bill McKibben, routinely recognize that the severity of the situation increases with each passing moment. So this is an article published just 2 days ago in the New Republic. Bill McKibben writes, quote, the future of humanity depends on math, and the numbers in the new study released Thursday are the most ominous yet. Those numbers spell out, in simple arithmetic, how much of the fossil fuel in the world's existing coal mines and oil wells we can burn if we want to prevent global warming from cooking the planet. In other words, if our goal is to keep the Earth's temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius, the upper limit identified by the nations and scientists of the world, how much more digging and drilling can we do today? Well, here's the answer. Zero. Absolutely none. That's right. To continue to quote McKibben, if we're serious about preventing catastrophic warming, the new study shows we can't dig any new coal mines, drill any new fields, build any more pipelines, not a single one. We're done expanding the fossil fuel frontier. Our only hope is a swift, managed decline in the production of all carbon-based energy from the fields we've already put into production. The reason I point that out and the reason I use McKibben is because in the people that I'm reading and the climate scientists that I'm checking out, McKibben actually falls more on the conservative end. But the important point, and the point that McKibben makes throughout the article, is that we should be facing and we should be preparing to face the absolute worst. Because year after year after year, each new study that comes out is worse than the one that came out before it. So when there's a new study that comes out next month that says, you know what, we studied these numbers for 2 decades, and my God, it's just this much worse than we thought it was going to be, that has been the trend for 25 years of climate science. So McKibben's point, my point, people like Guy McPherson's point, people like Derek Jensen who are making this point as well, is that we should be preparing for the absolute worst, and we should be resisting as though our lives depend on it. Now, to end this section on climate, I want to quote Anne and Paul Ehrlich. These are great biologists from Australia. I've had the chance of meeting. They've been doing great work for many, many decades now. And the point they're making, again, highlights part of what I mentioned earlier, and that's that our generation of activists, this new generation of people who are coming up, are facing a context that is in many ways quite unprecedented. So according to the Ehrlichs, Australian Biologies, this in the peer-reviewed journal Proceedings of a Royal Society, quote, virtually every past civilization has eventually undergone collapse, a loss of socio-political economic complexity usually accompanied by a dramatic decline in population size. Some, such as civilizations in Egypt and China, have recovered from collapses at various stages. Others, such as that of the Easter Island or the classic Maya, were apparently permanent. All those previous collapses were local or regional. Somewhere elsewhere, other societies and civilizations persisted unaffected. Sometimes, as in the Tigris and Euphrates valleys, new civilizations arose in succession. In many, if not most cases, over-exploitation of the environment was one proximate or ultimate cause of collapse. But today, for the first time in humanity's history, human global civilization, the worldwide, increasingly interconnected, highly technological society in which we are all one degree or another embedded, is threatened with collapse by an array of environmental problems. The reason I end with that quote is because today people are focusing on climate change. And yes, as others have argued, climate change may very well pose the most significant existential threat. But it is not just climate change. And it is not just making a transition to green technology. And this is where we get into talking about activism. This is where we get into talking about what is it exactly that we should do. Because when we talk about switching from a fossil fuel-based industry to a green technology, or however people want to say this, renewable energy systems, here I would quote my friend Derek, who would say, any way of life based on the use of non-renewable energy is doomed to failure. That much is pretty obvious to understand. But also, any way of life that is based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable energy is also doomed to fail. So this idea that we're just going to live within a capitalist system, everything's going to be fine, we'll continue all of these same structures and so on, but we'll just switch from using coal and natural gas and nuclear energy and petrol products to using solar and wind and so on is false. And I think many new people who are involved, including many of the younger environmental activists that I'm speaking with, I think really understand this. They want a more nuanced discussion about what that kind of a just transition would look like, how many resources can we use. As Kim and I have talked about in the past, what standard of living could what will be 9 billion people who are living on this planet by 2050 live at that would be sustainable? Because obviously, living in the United States, where we have 5% of the world's population, but we use 33% of the world's resources, isn't going to cut it. And it isn't going to cut it talking about the environment, just talking about climate change, and not talking about deforestation, overfishing, the use of plastics, where we dump this material, production lines, supply chains, and so on. And we can go on down the list, rivers being polluted, waterways being polluted, so on and so forth. But the conversation, in my opinion, becomes much more interesting when we broaden it out. And we say, no, it's not just climate change, and no, it's not just running our economy on fossil fuels, because only what the numbers are, it's like 55 to 60% of the petrol that is extracted is used actually to run engines. The other 40 to 45% of the petrol that's extracted is used for different plastics. So your car, for instance, your car tires, everything that's in this room, this table, anything that's polyester, so on and so forth. So everything you look at in this room is a great example that's made out of a plastic material comes from that level of extraction. So it's not just so much, you know, people, and of course I agree, you want to abolish capitalism, that's fine. I'm for it. I was for it 10 years ago. I'm still for it. I also think part of the issue is industrialization. And if you speak with indigenous activists, and I've had a great opportunity to work with Aboriginal activists in Australia, I've had a great opportunity to work with Native American activists here. The biggest difference I can find from traditional leftists who come from a traditional left background, anarchist, communist, Marxist, socialist, and so on, is a completely different view in terms of the living world that I get from indigenous activists. And if you listen to the lectures, if you read the histories, if you look at the material that's being produced now from the activists in places like North Dakota or South Dakota, it is a different view of the natural world. It's not a natural world that can be managed, a natural world that can be sort of shifted to human needs, used when humans want it, discarded when humans want to, done when humans want to, protected when humans want to protect it, but it's looking at the natural world as a partner in our existence. And this gets much deeper than just, hey, how do we come up with some policies and some laws that can fix this? No, this is going to require people to radically change the ways in which they view themselves within this context and the ways in which they view the natural world. And one of the most important things we need to do is to talk about this idea of human supremacism, this idea that human beings are the most important species on this planet. Because everything that follows after that allows us, it's a justification for everything we want to do. If human beings are the most important people on the planet, well, anything we need to do to the rivers to make sure that human beings can live in the short term, that's fine. Anything we can do to the forest to make sure that human beings can live in the short term, that's fine too. This is some of the more important, I think, conversations, debates, and so on that we should be having if we're going to talk about ecology, if we're going to talk about living on a living planet in the future. And then, as I mentioned before, the question most of my friends are asking is not so much, it's interesting, I hear people talk about revolution, and again, that's great, I'm for it, I've been for it, I think we should be building movements that are capable of doing that, but within this context of collapse, a lot of the activists I'm speaking with as well, and a good friend of mine, Samantha Castro, is going to be in town from Australia next week. She heads the Friends of the Earth office in Melbourne, Australia, probably the most radical NGO that's out there, in my opinion. At least environmental NGO. A lot of the NGOs and the environmental side is so. This is a great one in Australia. Part of what she's been talking about with a lot of the communities they're organizing with is how to brace for impact. Because I hear people talking like, we'll build the Green Party. And how long is that going to take? Oh, 10, 20 years. Oh, well, according to the data, in 20 years, we're not going to have fish in the ocean. So in 20 years, if Jill Stein or her predecessor or whatever, her successor, I'm sorry, becomes a viable candidate for president, that's great, but at the same time, we won't have fish in the ocean. So that means two things. That means either one, we build a movement big enough to do both, which means to build electoral capacity. We don't have the numbers for that. But to build the electoral capacity necessary to get people elected or to have a new political party while simultaneously having enough momentum and numbers to direct action, civil disobedience, protests, educational events, and so on. Of course, in my opinion, all of this should be part of one program, but we don't have the numbers for that. So when Samantha in Australia was asking me, what do you think about what's going on in North Dakota? I said, it's awesome. I mean, how could anyone in their right mind who's sitting in this room, you know, sort of poo-poo that and say, oh my, yeah, it's just nonsense or whatever. It's great. And we should use those lessons. We should use that information to help build new campaigns, coalitions, and so on. But it also is a sign of our limitations. That is quite literally where we are at. The ability to stop one segment of one small project. That is where we're at. We could stop the Keystone and simultaneously there's 15 other pipelines that go in at the same time. We can stop North Dakota, but at the same time, Obama okayed offshore drilling in the Atlantic. They're going to drill in the Arctic and so on and so forth. Now, is this to bash all of the people who are involved? The answer is no. I give all of them, myself and everyone in this room, a ton of credit for staying involved, for being out there, for speaking out and being courageous. That's not the point. The point for me is, again, getting to the point of this conversation, is how can we build more effective movements? How can we take those lessons and expand them out? How can we build a movement that would be simultaneously capable of stopping a pipeline being put in North Dakota, but also run congressional candidates, but also be involved in, say, maybe more revolutionary behavior? Because, to be honest with you folks, and I say this as someone whose life has been virtually destroyed by violence, and I've seen violence destroy people's lives for the last 14 years of my life, since I was 18 years old. But I'm not a pacifist. I'm not a nonviolent dogmatist. In my opinion, as soon as I left the Marine Corps in 2006, I said, yeah, these people, they're willing to kill anybody in the world to get exactly what they want. And in order to stop entities like that, you know, am I prescribing martyrdom to people? No, but I'm sorry, in my lifetime, people are going to die. We're facing the most powerful entities in the world. These oil companies are willing to kill all of us. They have known about climate change for the last 40 years and used the same PR companies that the tobacco industry used to try and misinform people for the last 40 years. They don't care. So this idea that, oh, a few marches, a few votes, people will get arrested, my God, people might get beat up by the cops. Yeah, all that's already happening. My assumption is in the future, we're going to need to build movements where people are willing to put their lives on the line, literally willing to put their lives on the line, to not only defend themselves and their communities, but to defend the planet. Now, that's not a prescription for a bunch of lunatics running around with AK-47s and so on. What that is, though, is a suggestion that anyone who's interested in building a resistance movement needs to talk about what that resistance movement actually looks like to combat the most powerful military, empire, industrial complex the world has ever seen. And obviously we know this. Someone like Martin Luther King called the United States the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. This was 40 years ago, 45 years ago. In 45 years, it's become only that much more brutal, that much more violent, and that much more powerful in some ways. So, you know, some people think that that's really depressing. I don't. I mean, honestly, a lot of us, you know, we've come to this conclusion a long time ago. I mean, a lot of us, I think, are looking at the situation saying, okay, we can continue to do what we're doing and resist and pat each other on the back and go to these events and set up fundraisers and so on, and we could all just make ourselves feel good until it's over with. Or we can take a step back, look at what we're doing, and come to the conclusion that it's not working. We've had an environmental movement for 45 years in this country. 45 years since the beginning of the environmental movement in this country. And I'm sorry, folks, every single ecological indicator is worse today than it was 45 years ago. We've had the beginnings of a vibrant anti-war movement 45 years ago. And I'm sorry, folks, but the empire is that much bigger than it has ever been. That, again, isn't to just, hey, well, that's it, let's go home. In my thinking, what I'm interested to do, why I'm here today, why Robert asked me to come here, is to have a conversation about why that is, number one, and number two, what could we do to fix that? And if there is no, again, I'm not trying to say there's a solution, that there's easy answers. I'm looking for suggestions from people. I think we should all be looking for suggestions from one another. And I think we should also be really nice to one another, because I spent 2.5 years when I did a radio podcast out of Michigan City, Indiana, interviewing all of my heroes for many, many years. It was like, I have a radio show, my God, how can I start talking to people like Chomsky or Judith Butler or Cornel West or Vandana Shiva or go on down the list? And I'm here to tell you, folks, I don't know if you read all these people's work or pay attention to them, they also don't have many answers. There's a ton of analysis going on the left right now. If you look at Truth Out, you look at Common Dreams, you look at Counterpunch, you look at ZNet, Black Agenda Report, go down the list. Tons of excellent analysis. Excellent. But in terms of what can we do, what should we do, suggestions for resistance, ideas about the future, visions for what another society would look like, the kind of values we want to base that society on, or what the political program would look like to get to that kind of a society, those conversations are lacking. In fact, they're utterly missing. There's people simply going through the routine saying, hey, we can conduct single-issue campaigns, we can do civil disobedience, we can stop X, Y, or Z projects. But in terms of coming up with a coherent political platform that can be expressed not only through these acts of civil disobedience and single-issue campaigns, but also in an electoral sphere, in an educational context, and so on, that really doesn't exist. I mean, there's a ton of people out there who are going to tell you how bad things are, but we don't have many people out there, and I'm encouraging anyone who's going to watch this, anyone who's going to listen to this, that we need more people writing about what they want. We need more discussions about what it is people want and what to do. Because, as I mentioned before, most average people, I think they're ahead of the curve. I think they're ahead of where average leftists give them credit for. I could talk to my neighbors and they're not reading Chomsky or Bill McKibben's reports or whatever. And I talk to my neighbors and they're like, Vince, we're So it's not convincing them, oh, your life's bad. No, they know. They're making $7.25 an hour. They don't have health insurance. Their lives are shit. No prospects for the future. They know the environment's getting screwed up. So it's not me sitting there trying to convince my neighbors or people we're knocking on their doors for campaigns that, hey, you know, things are pretty bad. They're looking at me saying, no, tell me something I don't know. And then we say, well, you know, you can get involved with a movement. And then the next response is, well, what good is that going to do? That's up to us. I mean, we have to create the kind of movements and the kind of spaces that people want to come to. It's not going to be, hey, we'll put out the best analysis possible and maybe they'll read it, maybe they won't. And if they don't read it, that's their own fault. They're just another brain-dead, stupid-ass American, and what can we expect from them anyway? No. Nowhere else does that happen. I mean, what I see on the left is sort of a lack of introspection, a lack of reflective capacity. You know, people really don't, it's really hard, and I understand this, because my friends who are full-time organizers, I don't consider myself an organizer, I consider myself an activist. My friends who are organizers, day in, day out, knocking on doors, phone calls, fundraisers, sitting down, meetings, compromises, talking to people they don't want to talk to. I can't do it. I don't have the patience for it. But I pay attention to the people who are doing it, because those are often the people who have really good ideas about what it means to organize, their lessons from organizing, what's working, what's not working. And what they're telling me, from the MTO to the Fight for 15 to the environmental movement to Black Lives Matter, number one, sectarianism is a problem. Number two, identity politics and self-affirmation are a problem. Number three, living in a leftist bubble is a problem. Number four, personalities have been a problem. Number five, and this is getting, I think, to more substantive conversations, a lack of vision, as I mentioned earlier, and also a lack of reflection and an inability to self-critique. When you put all of your energy and effort into a campaign, it's hard to sit back 6 months later and go, you know what? It really wasn't that good. That's tough for anybody here who's done that. For anybody here who's tried to run, not only, I'm not talking about electoral campaigns here, I'm talking about single issue campaigns, like we want to stop this pipeline. If that doesn't work after 6 to 12 months, it's very hard for those organizers and activists to sit back and then say, you know what? What we were doing, the approach we took, the methods we used, they didn't work. Now, how do we get better from this? And having those conversations openly and honestly in public venues such as today, I think, personally, is the only way people are going to learn how we can build these movements for the future. So without rambling anymore, because I know it's 4 o'clock, I'm going to leave it there, and I'd rather open it up for Q&A. Thank you.
Vincent Emmanuel, speaking in Chicago, September 24, 2016. Our thanks to Dale Lehman of WZRD, who made the original recording, which I have slightly edited and condensed. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to more insightful commentary from a progressive perspective, check out the archive of our shows at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, asking, if not you, who? Reminding you that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and hoping you'll come back again next week. Ciao.